by Lieutenant Horihashi Takeshi of the Chitose would consist of 19 Mitsubishi F1M Type 0 observation seaplanes called the Pete, 8 from the Chitose, 2 from Kamikawa Maru, 4 from Sanyo Maru, and 5 from Sanuki Maru, each armed with 2 130-pound fragmentation bombs. These biplanes would have an escort of 2 float zeros from the Kamikawa Maru. Since biplanes were not exactly cutting-edge aeronautical technology, this attack would take place at twilight, approaching from south of Guadalcanal in the hope of catching the American fighters on the ground. American radar spoiled Admiral Jojima's surprise as it picked up the approaching Japanese at around 5:30 p.m. 6 Marine Fighting 224 and 5 Saratoga Wildcats were sent up. The 2 float zeros were spotted first. One was shot down and the other driven off before the 19 Petes approached Henderson Field from the southeast, looking like some World War I reenactment. In the growing darkness, most of the Wildcats missed the biplanes, but not all. 2 Petes were shot down, and a third, that of Lieutenant Horihashi, was so badly shot up that it capsized and burned as soon as it arrived back at Rakata. The bombing attack was almost entirely ineffective, destroying just one Aero Cobra that had already been written off. So ineffective, in fact, that Jojima largely gave up the idea of massed bombing attacks on the airfield in the future. While the air attacks continued, at 1:05 on October 14th, General Kawaguchi led his forces away from the ridge. Still debating where exactly they should go, it was at 9 p.m. on October 15th that he finally ordered his troops to head west across the Matanako and join Colonel Oka's troops. The Taivu Point position was east of the Lunga perimeter and required reinforcements to cross within sight of American troops. The Kokumbona area west of the Matanako made more sense. So General Kawaguchi and his troops set out for Kokumbona. They were crossing the upper reaches of the Lunga on the lower ridges of Mount Austin in the deepest jungle with nearly every soldier involved in carrying wounded, and with no food. They had only taken a few days' rations from Tasimboko because they expected to quickly capture the airfield, after which they expected to dine on American food. Arrogant, overconfident, sloppy. By the time they arrived in Kokumbona at around 2 p.m. on September 19th, General Kawaguchi's troops looked like ghouls, skeletal, barely moving, having shed their weapons out of physical weakness due to exhaustion, thirst, and hunger. The troops of General Oka and Captain Monzen were not in much better shape, desperately low on food themselves, but not nearly as bad as the Kuma Battalion, who set out from Taivu Point trying to follow Kawaguchi to Kokumbona as well. They got lost in the jungle for 3 weeks, losing all their weapons and becoming near ghouls themselves. This, in turn, was a far better fate than that experienced by the laborers of the 11th and 13th construction units. These laborers dragged from Korea and Okinawa to this dismal corner of the world to build the airfield now in American hands, were now summarily dismissed, marooned on Guadalcanal and told to forage for themselves. It was truly the co-prosperity in Japan's Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. Imperial General Headquarters didn't care about their conscripted laborers dying of starvation, but it did care about their own troops dying of starvation. So began a series of food runs of the Tokyo Express. On the night of September 20th, destroyers Suzunami, Ushio, Yudachi, and Shikinami, each towing a barge full of provisions and ammunition, drawn from the seaplane carrier Nishin, headed for the Japanese anchorage at Kamimbo. They were found in the dark by 7 Navy Dauntlesses of Scouting 3 and 3 Marine Scout Bombing 231 Dauntlesses under the Saratoga's Lieutenant Commander Kern. Kern himself slightly damaged the Shikinami with a near miss. The next night it was the Uranami, Shirayuki, Kaguro, and Hamakaze making the run. The Cactus Air Force found them again. Strafing caused the Kaguro waterline damage that led to flooding near the bow. The destroyers were only able to offload 2/3 of their supplies before turning back to Shortland. On September 24th, a run that included Suzukaze, Kawakaze, Urakaze, and Umikaze, carrying 280 men of the 4th Infantry Regiment, had to be aborted when 9 Dauntlesses and 1 Avenger got near misses on the Urakaze and Umikaze. By this time, though, the new Japanese plan with the old name of Operation Ka was in motion. Hanson Baldwin was the New York Times military affairs correspondent, A 1924 graduate of the Naval Academy, he had served in the Navy before going into journalism. That background gave him access and insight that would be unheard of today. On September 19th, Baldwin accompanied Admiral Fitch on a visit to Guadalcanal. Fitch was familiarizing himself with his new command area, and Baldwin was doing what reporters do, gathering information and giving information. Baldwin met General Vandegrift and gave him some rather disconcerting news. The reporter told the general that the American public were under the false impression that the Marines held most of Guadalcanal. The public was completely unaware of the conditions under which the troops were living and fighting. Washington was aware of those conditions, but top officials were deeply concerned about the situation and seemed ready to give up. The attitude was even worse in Noumea, where the harbor was packed with supply ships waiting to be unloaded because of the disorganization of Admiral Garmley's headquarters, where defeatism had clearly taken hold. Vandegrift bristled at the idea that his troops were on the verge of defeat. He pointed out that they had finally stopped the Japanese advance across the Pacific, during which the Japanese had suffered heavy naval and air losses from which they might not quickly recover. In fact, the American offensive on Guadalcanal seemed to have taken them by surprise. Baldwin's question was blunt. "Are you going to hold this beachhead, General? Are you going to stay here?" "Hell yes. Why not?" It would become General Vandegrift's most famous quote. Not as a battle cry. American troops were not going to storm enemy positions hollering, "Why not?" But it was a message of optimism, of hope, in the face of a vicious enemy and weak-kneed or ambivalent superiors. Those weak-kneed superiors were a major problem in this campaign, none bigger than Admiral Garmley. Baldwin went to Pearl Harbor, where he told a similar story to Admiral Nimitz. The poor results of the South Pacific campaign so far had come from overcaution and the defensive complex, an outgrowth of that defeatism. Perhaps most surprisingly, Garmley had never visited Guadalcanal. Despite being in Noumea, the Paris of the Pacific, he had never even left his flagship Argonne. Baldwin later elaborated. Garmley was almost despairing. He was heavily overworked, and he said, "This is a shoestring operation. We haven't got enough of anything. We're just hanging on by our teeth." He was very frank about this. Here was a time when you needed tough, hard, almost ruthless men. He was miscast, in my opinion. He should never have been in that job. He was a superb planner, and he should have been kept as a planner. But I don't think he was a good operator. The staff didn't share these impressions entirely, but they were becoming infected. So the whole thing was very unpleasant. Baldwin was not the only journalist with this impression. Associated Press correspondent Clark Lee gave this insight. "It seemed to me some officers thought only of not losing more ships, and it was in that mood that we undertook our early operations in the Solomons." Admiral Nimitz decided he had to go to the South Pacific himself and personally check on his South Pacific commander. Admiral Yamamoto's promise to Colonel Tsuji was the culmination of more than a week of negotiations between the Imperial Army and Navy at multiple levels. The negotiations came on the heels of some not entirely consistent analyses on what exactly was happening on Guadalcanal and why it had gone so wrong. The Naval General Staff believed that the island represented the all-out American counterattack. The Imperial Army disagreed because the Americans had not dedicated sufficient logistical assets for the offensive, which was perhaps a side benefit of the Americans actually not dedicating sufficient logistical assets to the operation. There was considerable pointing of fingers. The Imperial Army blamed the Navy for not controlling the air over Guadalcanal. The Navy responded that it had committed almost all of its air and submarine assets to the Solomons, but did acknowledge, as Admiral Yamamoto had, that its supply efforts had been inadequate. In turn, the Army General Staff acknowledged, at least privately, that perhaps the bamboo spear tactics of charging with bayonets and swords needed some fine-tuning. These analyses took place in the shadow of negotiations between the two services for the next steps. The major part was in Rabaul, between General Yakutake's 17th Army and Admiral Mikawa's 8th Fleet, but essential parts were crafted at Imperial General Headquarters and on board the Yamato. The plan that emerged had the land offensive to retake the Lunga airfield starting on October 20th. Backtracking from that, the troops and equipment had to be in place by October 13th or 14th. The plan would consist of five elements. 1. For 2 weeks starting October 1st, troops would be run into Guadalcanal by high-speed night runs consisting of any combination of 27 destroyers, a tactic the Japanese called rat transportation. 2. At the same time, artillery, armor, more supplies, and other heavy equipment would be run in from Shortland by General Kawaguchi's beloved barges, which the Japanese called ant transportation. 3. Runs on October 3rd and 6th by the seaplane tender Nishin to bring in heavy artillery. 4. Increased air attacks on the airfield. Starting on September 26th, the projected completion date for the new airfield at Buin. 5. A high-speed convoy that included 5 transports, led by Admiral Yamamoto, to run reinforcements directly to Guadalcanal. It was a logical plan in general. It did represent a major change for the combined fleet, inasmuch as the mission now was not the destruction of the Pacific Fleet, but support for the Guadalcanal land offensive. It came with one catch, as plans always do. Once the combined fleet was at sea, it could stay at sea no longer than 2 weeks. After that, it would have to refuel and resupply. Imperial Navy staffers tried to drill this important point into Colonel Tsuji and his army colleagues, whether they understood it is anyone's guess. To carry out the plan, the 17th Army requested serious reinforcements, and it would get them, including the 2nd Sendai Division, the 38th Kanoya Division under Major General Ito Takeo, with a proud history of conquering Hong Kong, Sumatra, and Timor, and an equally sad history of war crimes, and the 8th Tank Regiment. For now, though, it was all about that base air force. On September 16th, the 1st Air Attack Force, 21st Air Flotilla, began staging into Kavieng, north of Rabaul on New Ireland. First to arrive was Commanding Officer Rear Admiral Ichimaru Rinosuke, who had a reputation for being a fire-eater, and much of the Konoya air group. 7 of the Konoya's Zeros were sent to Rabaul to leaven the chewed-up Tainan air group. From the East Indies, the 3rd Air Attack Force, 23rd Air Flotilla, loaned elements of the 3rd Air Group, which the Japanese considered the equal of the Tainan Air Group in terms of air combat skills. They were brought to Kavieng by the new Japanese escort carrier, Taiyo. The 23rd also loaned elements of the Takao Air Group with 20 G-4Ms. The 31st Air Group sent 9 Type 99 carrier bombers, which were loaded alongside various other aircraft for delivery on board the Taiyo, which was due to deliver them to Truk. When she was 40 miles south of Truk, the escort carrier, under the escort of the destroyers Akebono and Ushio, was smacked in the stern by a Mark 14 torpedo, one of 5 fired by the U.S. submarine Trout. With 13 dead, the Taiyo staggered into Truk later that day for emergency repairs. She was the first Japanese aircraft carrier hit by U.S. submarine torpedoes. She would not be the last. The surviving air crews of the badly mauled 4th and Yokohama air groups were finally sent back to Japan, and the survivors of the Chitose Air Group were sent back to the Marshall Islands. But for the exhausted survivors of the Tainan Air Group, there would be no relief. All told, these moves meant that, as of September 24th, Base Air Force had 62 G-4Ms, 77 Zeros, of which 48 were the long-range model, 5 Kawanishi Type 97 and 1 Type 2 flying boats, 5 Type 99 carrier bombers, 5 Mitsubishi C-5M2 Type 98 land reconnaissance planes, known to the Allies as BABs, and 1 Nakajima J-1N-1 reconnaissance plane. Admiral Tsukahara reorganized Base Air Force for improved efficiency, placing all the fighters under the 5th Air Attack Force and all the bombers under the 6th Air Attack Force. He also sent 1 Lieutenant Commander Mitsui Kenji, former air officer of the 4th Air Group, and 10 communications personnel to monitor the weather and the Lunga airfield from the friendly confines of Mount Austin. Base Air Force now outnumbered the Cactus Air Force 2-1 in fighters and 3-1 in bombers. But for now, bad weather kept it from exercising those numerical advantages. The morning of September 19th, transport Shirogane Maru, carrying elements of the 16th Construction Unit to Bougainville, took a torpedo in her engine room courtesy of the submarine USS Amberjack under Lieutenant Commander John A. Bull and went dead in the water. The destroyers Amagiri and Hatsuyuki went out to lug the disabled transport back to the Shortlands, where the Shirogane Maru was beached to keep her from sinking. Her cargo was unloaded, but she was eventually declared a total loss. Shortland was starting to get some heat, as a September 24th attack by 11th Bombardment Group B-17s, staging through Henderson Field, damaged seaplane tender Sanuki Maru, though she does not seem to have missed any combat time. One B-17 was shot down. The bad weather that had stymied Japanese efforts to bomb the Lunga airfield finally broke on September 27th. At 10:30 a.m., the new improved base air force sent up 9 G-4Ms of the Kisarazu Air Group and 9 from the Takao Air Group, making its first attack on Guadalcanal. They were escorted by 26 Zeros of the 3rd Air Group, with 12 from the 2nd Air Group serving as air control. The incoming strike was picked up on radar early enough for 9 Wildcats from Marine Fighting 223 and 8 from Marine Fighting 224 to take off from Fighter 1, joined by 14 Saratoga Wildcats from Henderson Field itself. There was no semblance of squadron order, as everyone simply formed themselves up as best they could once in the air. The Wildcats were helped immensely by the 12 Air Control Zeros completely missing them altogether. The Bettys from the Takao group saw a dozen approaching Wildcats, but could not warn the Zeros because the Zeros, of course, lacked radios. The bombers managed to destroy one Dauntless on the ground while damaging 3 others along with 5 Avengers. 5 Wildcats were perforated in the air battle and needed repairs. 1 Kisarazu Betty and 1 Takao Betty were shot down over Guadalcanal, while a 2nd Takao Betty had to ditch at Rakata. All of the rest had some form of damage. 1 Zero was shot down, 1 more had slight damage. September 28th saw another massive raid by base air force. Lieutenant Morita Rinji of the Misawa Air Group led 27 Mitsubishi G-4Ms, 9 each from the Misawa, Kanoya, and Takao Air Groups, escorted by 15 Zeros from the Tainan Air Group, under Lieutenant Kawai. Today in the role of air control were 27 Zeros, 18 from the 6th and 9 from the Kanoya Air Groups, under Lieutenant Kofukuda Mitsugi of the 6th. Though as air control, Kofukuda was to sweep ahead of the main strike for Zeros, for reasons known only to him, he took off 40 minutes after the main strike did. The attack thus got off to a bad start. Things rapidly got worse. One of Lieutenant Kofukuda's Zeros had to abort. Then Lieutenant Kawai developed engine trouble and had to abort, initially taking 8 other Zeros with him, before he could turn over command of the close escort thanks, again, to the lack of radio. 2 of the G-4Ms had to abort as well. With warning from Donald Kennedy and radar, 20 Marine Wildcats, 10 each from Fighting 223 and 224, and 15 Saratoga Wildcats took to the air. Going to 28,000 feet, Major John L. Smith looked at the approaching Japanese with some bemusement. Why were some 24 Zeros too far behind the bombers to protect them? The Americans struck hard. Lieutenant Morita's Betty was fatally shot by the Saratoga's fighters. The other Bettys took Morita's spiraling out of formation as the signal for them to drop their bombs on a jungle trail about 10 miles west of Henderson Field. Even so, G-4M pilot Lieutenant Naka Seiji claimed to have destroyed 7 aircraft on the ground. With the Zeros almost completely out of it, it was a slaughter. Major Gaylor later said, "You could look back up and there were wings, motors, and tail assemblies floating all around." Lieutenant Colonel Harold W. Joe Bauer, a visitor to Guadalcanal, who had talked his way into this first combat of his career, wrote, "It was the greatest sight of my life to see Jap bombers fall out of the sky." 5 Bettys were shot down, including Lieutenant Morita's command plane. 1 ditched at Rakata, 1 crash-landed at Buin, and 1 made it back but was a total loss. 8 Mitsubishi G-4M Type 1 land attack planes were lost. All the rest suffered damage. 41 were killed. And with more performances like this, a new reality was slowly dawning on the American pilots. As usual, Admiral McCain was one of the first to pick up on it. Briefing staffers at Pearl Harbor, McCain described what was unthinkable just 6 months earlier. "The Japs are afraid of our F-4F and will not attack it," he said. "It seems reasonable to suppose that we have now destroyed the cream of the enemy's naval air pilots." McCain emphasized that Guadalcanal could be held if fighter strength could be maintained at the present level. "Unfortunately," he said, "there were not yet enough fighters or pilots to do that." That afternoon saw celebration inside the Lunga perimeter, at least to the extent one could celebrate on Guadalcanal, and the news got even better with the arrival of reinforcements. Lieutenant Commander John Eldridge, skipper of the Wasps Scouting 71, led two more of his squadron mates, three Dauntlesses from Scouting 3, and four Avengers from Torpedo 8. It was a good day at Lunga. At Rabaul, the atmosphere was markedly different. That night, a very ill Admiral Tsukahara convened a meeting of the staffs of the 5th and 6th Air Attack Forces with no shortage of yelling and finger-pointing. In 2 days, despite the assignment of what should have been an overwhelming escort of Zeros, Base Air Force had lost 11 bombers, almost 20% of its force. Why was this happening? What could be done to fix it? The 11th Air Fleet historian put it in cold, laconic terms. In today's attack, our bombers suffered heavy damage. Therefore, it was decided that tomorrow's attack will be carried out by fighters. The Battle of Edson's Ridge had bought the Marines some breathing room, nothing more. The Japanese would be back. But the pause allowed the Americans to take stock of their situation and make some needed changes. The first change would be the air crews. By this time, most of the Marine pilots had been at Henderson Field for over a month. It was a unique situation for pilots inasmuch as they served as pilots, but they basically lived as infantry. The air crews were housed in tents in a coconut grove between Henderson Field and the beach. Not entirely unpleasant in theory, though the air crews called it Mosquito Gulch, but a shortage of cots meant most of them slept on captured Japanese straw mats in the dirt that served as the floors of their tents. And when it rained, the dirt became a stinking black mud that could swallow cots or men whole. That was when the pilots could sleep. Indeed, the single biggest problem was sleep. Every night the Japanese sent someone over, Louis the Louse or Lately, a twin-engine Betty that was dubbed Washing Machine Charlie, to loudly fly over the Lunga positions, lighten them with flares, and drop the occasional bomb, just to keep the enemy forces there disturbed, as the Japanese would later explain. It worked. When the siren wailed at night, the pilots had to hide in foxholes, just like the infantry. They needed energy. They couldn't always get it. The food on Guadalcanal seemed suspiciously familiar. Spam, canned hash, sausage, spam, captured Japanese rice, dehydrated potatoes, spam, and whatever concoctions could be made thereof. With spam. And coffee. Nothing hits the spot in 100-degree temperatures and 100% humidity like a cup of boiling hot coffee. But it was the only caffeinated beverage they had. As delectable and varied as this menu seems, various emergencies and missions meant they could not always or even usually get 3 meals a day. During the day, they had to fly fighter missions or bombing missions, often at high altitude, where the pure oxygen they had to breathe made them drowsy, and where the stomach acids from the food they ate expanded and caused agonizingly painful cramps. This was on top of the normal stress of simply being a pilot, being in your cockpit all alone, with everyone you see in the air trying to kill you, and you have to decide which ones to kill. It may be a powerful experience, but it is also stressful, dehumanizing, and draining. Draining was something Henderson Field badly needed. Taking off and landing are difficult under any circumstances, but the runway at Henderson added a level of adventure to which few pilots were accustomed. There were the standard bomb craters. There was also not enough Marston matting, perforated steel planks that could be hooked together to create a temporary runway, to cover the runway. So they had to deal with the dirt strip, which the official Marine Corps aviation history described in not entirely complimentary terms. Henderson Field was a bowl of black dust, which fouled airplane engines, or it was a quagmire of black mud, which made the takeoff resemble nothing more than a fly trying to rise from a runway of molasses. The excitement did not end there, however. The Douglas SBD Dauntlesses were carrier planes, designed to land on aircraft carriers. They had hard rubber wheels under their tails, designed for landing on the tough wooden decks of aircraft carriers. But on the dirt runway of Henderson, these wheels chewed up the runway like a plowshare. The engineers and CBs had their hands full repairing the airstrip, combat or no combat. Repair teams and dump trucks full of dirt were kept at the ready for quick repairs. All in all, the Cactus Air Force pilots had to endure circumstances that were probably the worst any American airman faced for a prolonged period during the war. Unsurprisingly, the result was a number of pilots being declared unfit to fly by the medical staff of the 1st Marine Air Wing. Colonel Woods, the chief of staff, was indignant. "They've got to keep flying," he bellowed. "It's better to do that than get a jet bayonet stuck in their ass." The simple fact was they didn't have enough pilots. In general, the aviators of the Cactus Air Force were a hearty, cheeky bunch who took their lot with spunk and black humor that undoubtedly aided their survival. One of their favorite stories concerned a Marine Wildcat pilot who was cut off by Japanese Zeros. The defiant pilot radioed the rest of his flight, "Hey, fellows, come on over. I've got 12 of the bastards cornered." But the toll on the pilots was starting to show, with more operational accidents occurring. Very late in the afternoon of September 8th, when a Japanese airstrike was expected, 16 Wildcats were scrambled to meet it. One crashed on takeoff. The others stayed aloft until after dark, when it became obvious there would be no attack. Then the fighters came in to land. Two ran into each other on the runway, wrecking both planes. A third got stuck in the mud and pitched over, becoming a total loss. Then a fourth crashed on landing. One pilot lamented, "At this rate, we can whip ourselves without any help from the Japs." Other problems appeared as well. Dauntless pilots and radio men on reconnaissance missions would make basic errors of identification and navigation. The Marine Dauntless pilots had not gotten a direct hit on a Japanese ship with a bomb since they hit the Asagiri. All aviators, but especially fighter pilots, would make mistakes in combat, and a very few didn't even want to fight anymore. Calling such aviators almost worthless, Major Gaylor explained it. A percentage of these pilots could be said to avoid combat, while the majority would accept but not look for combat. After a definite period, a pilot who was undergoing daily alert periods in combat should be relieved before he is forced to request his relief from the medical department or before he is evacuated, sick or wounded. Lieutenant Turner Caldwell of the Enterprise agreed. He used to believe pilot fatigue was a myth. "Now I know what the medical staff meant. There's a point where you just get to be no good. You're shot to the devil, and there's nothing you can do about it." But how long was that definite period? One experienced pilot thought it was 6 weeks. Others thought it was a mere 30 days. Either way, the only solution was to rotate the air crews out. That process began on September 23rd, when 5 Dauntlesses of Marine Scout Bombing 141 arrived at Henderson Field. These were the first elements of Marine Air Group 14, who would little by little take over from Marine Air Group 23. Yet it was not just rotating the air crews. Admiral Halsey had requested the earliest practicable return of the carrier pilots and air crews. He hoped to use the least tired as cadre for replacement carrier air groups. Admiral Fitch replied that the carrier aviators would be returned when transportation and the military situation permitted. They permitted enough to give Halsey back the remaining pilots from the carrier Enterprise on September 27th, but the Cactus Air Force would continue to rely on carrier pilots for some time to come. This was because they would not be getting rid of the Japanese for some time to come. General Vandegrift had used the new troops to build up his defense, a series of strong points just inside the perimeter, with a reserve position to reinforce threatened sectors. But the general also had his eye on the Matanico. Starting on September 24th, Vandegrift had the 7th Marines lead a two-pronged strike, with one prong attacking across the Matanico and the other taking boats to land in the Japanese rear. The troops did not know what General Vandegrift hoped to accomplish by this mission, and neither did he, by his own admission. Colonel Oka used a defense of interior lines to thwart a Marine assault bogged down by poor communications and coordination within the jungle. It took a blasting by the 5-inch guns of the destroyer Monson to get some of the troops out. It was Vandegrift's second serious tactical misjudgment in 2 weeks. But this one was born of frustration at being cooped up inside the Lunga perimeter, and a fear that the Japanese would build up across the Matanico for a massive assault on Henderson Field, which was exactly what the Japanese were planning. On the afternoon of September 28th, a consolidated PB-2Y Coronado flying boat set down in Noumea Harbor. Out of it stepped Admiral Nimitz with his air officer and his marine officer. They got into a launch that took him to Admiral Garmley's flagship, Argonne. They were on a fact-finding mission that promised to not be entirely pleasant. The Admiral had already gathered considerable important information. On the way down from Pearl Harbor, he had stopped in Canton, where he crossed paths with Admiral McCain on his way to Washington to work for Admiral King. Nimitz asked McCain for a short briefing on what to look for in the South Pacific. "The first thing is to get as many reserve planes to Espiritu Santo as possible. Cactus cannot handle any more planes right now, but you have to be ready to feed them in all the time. Aviation gasoline supply at Cactus is the present most critical question." This dovetailed into more issues of logistics. There was discussion of how Admirals Noyes and Fletcher were doing. Then McCain added, "I want to emphasize the aviation gas supply and relief for pilots at Cactus. We can fly VF fighters up, but not back. It's a one-way wind. The Marine VF pilots are very tired. A relief for them is there now, and the SPD pilots will be next. They have had no rest. They are just tired. They had to work during the day and could get no sleep at night. The Marines are not worried about holding what they have on Cactus, but you have got to stop the Japs coming in." Nimitz would see just how right McCain was on this trip. It started as soon as he landed in Noumea, when Admiral Nimitz saw 80 cargo ships and freighters carrying badly needed supplies simply sat in the harbor, with the ships themselves badly needed elsewhere. They could not be sent to the front because they had not been combat-loaded, the most important supplies towed for first unloading, ammunition kept together, etc., in the United States. They could not be unloaded in Noumea because there were not enough docks, cranes, transport, or workers, which could usually handle only about 24 ships a month. They all had to be sent on to Wellington, New Zealand, to be unloaded and reloaded for combat in the midst of a longshoreman strike. The commander of the Pacific Fleet and his staff officers were directed to the wardroom. There was South Pacific Commander Admiral Garmley, his chief of staff Admiral Callaghan, and Admiral Turner. Also there was General Arnold, head of the Army Air Force, who was on his own tour of the South Pacific, General MacArthur's chief of staff, Major General Richard K. Sutherland, MacArthur's 5th Air Force Major General George Kenney, and Major General Millard Harmon, commander of Army Air in the South Pacific. As he entered the wardroom, Admiral Nimitz noted with some unease the physical appearance of Admiral Garmley, who to the Pacific Fleet commander looked exhausted, nervous, and overwhelmed. Nevertheless, Nimitz opened the conference around 4:15 p.m. "The purpose of my visit is to inform myself and members of my staff with conditions in the SOPAC, South Pacific, area, and to inform myself on the problems of Admiral Garmley and General MacArthur. We will begin the conference by having Garmley or Harmon outline the situation." Admiral Garmley started into his presentation. "Our forces in position there are under constant pressure. Logistics supply is most difficult. We can send in only one ship at a time, and from the eastward there is only one channel. Most of the Japs in the area are on Cactus. The Japs are still getting in despite our air activity. Nobody knows exactly how many are on Cactus right now." Well, at least Garmley did not. Clearly it might have helped if he had actually visited the island. At one point Garmley stated that Guadalcanal was down to 10,000 gallons of aviation fuel. Admiral Turner quickly corrected him. It was 5,000. His lack of knowledge about the situation on Guadalcanal left the other officers sharing uncomfortable looks. "I liked Garmley," General Kenny wrote, "but he looked tired and really was tired. I don't believe his health was any too good, and I thought, while we were talking, that it wouldn't be long before he was relieved." Admiral Nimitz asked tough questions of his South Pacific commander. Nimitz was surprised to learn the battleship Washington was in Tonga Tabu, 1,800 miles from Guadalcanal. What exactly was the battleship accomplishing there? The Washington was so far removed from the battle area that she might as well have been at Pearl or San Francisco, insofar as taking advantage of favorable opportunities is concerned. Garmley pled fuel shortages. How that justified keeping the battleship 1,800 miles away, rather than somewhere closer like Noumea, he did not explain. Nimitz also thought Garmley was keeping his cruiser task force too far from Guadalcanal to do much about visiting enemy ships. Twice during the conference, staffers intruded to deliver urgent messages for Admiral Garmley. Garmley had been given two urgent messages from Guadalcanal. Both times he exclaimed, "My God, what are we going to do about this?" It was as if he had no idea what to do and didn't want to find out. It made a big impression on those present, especially Admiral Nimitz. Admiral Garmley and his staff appealed for more help from General MacArthur's forces, including, especially, mass raids by heavy bombers on Rabaul. General Kenny agreed to try to burn the place down, but he also said that his units were stretched thin while knocking off Jap convoys to Buna, maintaining air control over New Guinea, and helping out our ground forces. Gormley responded that he appreciated what MacArthur's forces were doing and wished them luck when they did attack Rabaul. Nimitz seethed at Gormley's weak response. General Sutherland then presented General MacArthur's position, followed by Admiral Turner describing the South Pacific strategy. General Arnold was left to explain the global war, the grand strategy, and how, in the grand scheme of things, the South Pacific did not matter all that much, at least as he saw it. General Arnold's tour of the South Pacific had allegedly been about fact-finding, though the opinions he expressed made it sound as if it was more about confirmation bias. It was obvious that the naval officers in this area were under a terrific strain, Arnold acknowledged later on. It was also obvious that they had chips on their shoulders. He wrote, "It looked to me as if everybody on that South Pacific front had a bad case of jitters." General Arnold bristled at the Navy's requests for more aircraft from the Army. What had the Navy done with the aircraft the Army had already sent? Were they tied up in the shipping snarl at Noumea? He wanted no more Army aircraft sent to the South Pacific until the Navy used what it already had. That the Army aircraft available on Guadalcanal, the P-39 and P-400 era Cobras, were totally unsuitable for fighting Japanese Zeros did not matter to him. The Navy's problem, General Arnold insisted, was not a lack of aircraft, but a lack of airfields. It was a bizarre claim considering Espiritu Santo, Efati, and the rear airfields were nowhere near capacity. Indeed, no one had done more to block reinforcements to the Pacific than Arnold, and Arnold was not interested in learning anything that might change his mind. As the 67th Fighter Squadron's Captain Dale Brannan was about to learn. After the meeting with Nimitz, Brannan, the highest-ranking Army officer on Guadalcanal, was summoned to Espiritu Santo for a meeting with Arnold. For all of Arnold's study of the Pacific, he would not visit Guadalcanal. Instead, Brannan was to brief him, or so he thought. When Brannan arrived, he sat at a table across from Arnold. Brannan was about to go into his prepared briefing when Arnold preempted him. "What the hell is going on with your people?" the head of the Army Air Force shouted. Brannan was thrown for a loop. He started to go into his remarks about the P-400s, but Arnold cut him off. "They're doing a fine job in Australia." "They have P-39s in Australia, not P-400s, sir, and they have oxygen." "That's not the case at all," Arnold snapped. "The Arrow Cobras were doing fine in New Guinea. They weren't on Guadalcanal. The Marines and Navy flyers got the news headlines for shooting down Japanese Zeros, but the Army pilots there ran from Japanese Zeros. Arnold didn't care about the Arrow Cobras' effective ground support role. Why weren't they shooting down Zeros over Guadalcanal?" Arnold had the answer. It was the pilots. General Arnold lunged across the table, pounding it with his fist. He snarled, "The problem is that you're a coward." Arnold chose not to notice the bandage across Brandon's chin from injuries he suffered in the September 10th Japanese bombing attack. He went eye to eye with Brannan. "You have a whole squadron full of nothing but cowards." Arnold stormed from the room, slamming the door behind him. It was a sorry performance by Hap Arnold. Captain Brannan had been stunned into silence. As he headed back for Guadalcanal, he was shaking with rage. Brannan had no idea that while this was going on, the 339th Fighter Squadron was created. It would eventually have the new P-38, and its head would be one of the original test pilots of the P-38, Dale Brannan. Meanwhile, on September 30th, Nimitz got on a B-17, headed in the general direction of Guadalcanal. The pilot did not have a map of the Solomons. He got a first-hand experience of the difficulty of flight in the Solomon Islands when the pilot got lost in a storm. His air officer remembered they had a National Geographic map of the South Pacific on board, which helped them find Henderson Field. Despite the pouring rain, which secretly pleased Vandegrift since it showed the issues of the muddy runway, Admiral Nimitz inspected the flight operations, Edson's Ridge, and parts of the defense perimeter. That evening, Nimitz dined with Vandegrift and the senior officers, then spoke with the general alone to get his real thoughts. Vandegrift and his troops were confident of holding Guadalcanal. Both Nimitz and General Arnold had found that optimism increased the closer one got to the front, although he did have issues with the Japanese, obviously, but also with Admiral Turner. Turner fancied himself a genius in land warfare as well as naval warfare. Vandegrift disagreed. The general said what he needed most were more troops to hold the perimeter and more aircraft to beat back the constant Japanese air attacks. Later that night, over alcoholic beverages, the Pacific Fleet commander got into more theoretical issues. "You know, Vandegrift, when this war is over, we are going to write a new set of Navy regulations," Nimitz said. "So just keep it in the back of your mind, because I will want to know some of the things you think ought to be changed." It was a measure of how much Nimitz had been impressed by the Marine general. He did not disappoint now. "I know one right now," Vandegrift said. "Leave out all reference that he who runs his ship aground will face a fate worse than death. Out here, too many commanders have been far too leery about risking their ships." It was a standard pre-war Navy philosophy that had been drummed into the heads of the skippers. Now it was getting people killed. It went a long way in explaining why, for instance, the lightly armed destroyer transports Little and Gregory chose death at the hands of the Japanese rather than risk running aground off Tulagi in the dark and receive a fate worse than death from the Navy bureaucracy. Nimitz smiled. The next morning the admiral handed out merit citations, including one to a burly Marine sergeant who fainted out of sheer terror at being this close to a four-star admiral. As Vandegrift and Nimitz headed back to the Henderson Field runway in the rain, again, the admiral promised support to the maximum of our resources. The necessity of those resources was proven again when Nimitz's B-17 could not take off out of the mud and nearly spun off the runway into a deep ravine. After the rain stopped and the field dried a bit, Nimitz and his staff headed back to Espiritu Santo and then Noumea, where he met Admiral Gormley again on October 2nd. This time Nimitz directed the meeting. He wanted support for Guadalcanal, no doubt. The Army's AmeriCal division was being trained in New Caledonia. Against the wishes of its commander, Major General Alexander M. Patch, Gormley had refused to commit the division, believing it would be lost when Guadalcanal inevitably fell to the Japanese. Nimitz wanted it sent forward. In fact, Admiral Nimitz gave very definite and very forceful instructions that left no doubt what he wanted from his South Pacific commander. All-weather airfields, which meant a lot more Marston manning, a direct consequence of the difficult landing and takeoff Nimitz experienced at Henderson Field, more storage for aviation gasoline, better housing for pilots, in particular Quonset huts instead of tents, all-weather roads, which meant even more Marston manning, better communications, better cargo handling facilities, better repair facilities for aircraft. Planes are too expensive and too hard to get to let only minor damage render them permanently unserviceable, Admiral Nimitz explained. Better handling of mail, which could do wonders for morale. Perhaps most importantly, he told Gormley, I want you to go up and see conditions for yourself. Callaghan can take care of things here while you are away. Admiral Nimitz also wanted ideas of future operations. Admiral Gormley discussed the old holy grail of building an airbase at Andeni, ignoring the mounting evidence that the Santa Cruz Islands were actually biological hazards that included their own particularly nasty strain of malaria that attacked the human brain. More disturbingly, the Joint Chiefs had ordered him to supply a plan and schedule for future operations last August. Gormley had not done so, as he had not believed it to be worthwhile. This was a major failure on Gormley's part. Nimitz left Noumea the next day to make a few more inspections before returning to Pearl Harbor. His visit had not settled his concerns about Gormley. If anything, what Nimitz had seen had intensified those concerns. The Pacific Fleet commander hoped his instructions and admonitions to his South Pacific commander would be enough. Admiral Tsukahara and Base Air Force had a problem. When they sent bombers with fighters down to attack Guadalcanal, the Americans would simply ignore the fighters and go after the bombers. That struck the Japanese as rude. Their solution had been what they termed air control. A fighter sweep would lead the main bomber force with a close fighter escort. However, the Americans, helped in part by radar and the coast watchers, had still cut through the fighters and slashed away at the bombers. Now Base Air Force tried a new tactic. Now the Japanese would lead with bombers, but just enough to get the Americans to scramble fighters. Then the bombers would turn back and let a swarm of Zeros pass by to deal with the Americans. They first tried this tactic on September 29th. Lieutenant Aoi Takahide led 27 Zeros from the 3rd Air Group and the Kanoya Air Group. They were joined at 10 a.m. by 9 Konoya T-4Ms from Kavieng. At 8:45, Coast Watcher Jack Reed on southern Bougainville reported fighters and bombers had passed overhead at 7:30 and were now going yours. Due to the delay in reporting, fighters were almost immediately scrambled at Henderson Field. The Bettys turned around in the central Solomons, but no one seems to have seen them do so. When no attack materialized that morning, the fighters landed, only to be sent back up at 1:25 p.m., when radar detected a large flight of unidentified aircraft. Now it was 20 Marine Wildcats and 14 Saratoga fighting 5 Wildcats. What resulted was an aerial battle that took bizarre turns because of heavy cloud cover. There were 27 attacking Japanese Zeros, but only 19 of them engaged the Americans. The 20 Marine Wildcats never fought at all. They never saw anyone to fight. It was the Saratoga Wildcats that held the line, losing one of their own, but ended up costing the Japanese 4 Zeros. It was another unhappy day for Base Air Force. Fighter pilot Petty Officer 3rd Class Abe Kenichi was taken aback by the skill and aggressiveness of the American pilots. He had been taught that the F-4F Wildcat would break off an attack and dive away when the Zero fought back, but Abe didn't see that. He saw pilots who wanted combat with the Zeros, who did not fear the Zeros. Abe called it a frightening surprise. He might have also called it ominous. There were no Japanese air attacks for the next few days, in part because of bad weather between Rabaul and Guadalcanal, but the bad weather helped cover the Tokyo Express. On October 1st, it was the destroyers Fubuki, Shirayuki, Atsuyuki, and Murakumo dropping off Major General Nasu Yumio and members of the 4th Infantry Regiment. The Cactus Air Force tried to mount another night attack with 5 each of Dauntlesses and Avengers, but all they managed to accomplish was to give the Hatsuyuki steering issues at the cost of losing all but one of the Avengers. As the Americans suffered their slings and arrows, so did the Japanese. Just before dawn, on October 2nd, 6 B-17s of the 5th Air Force's 19th Bombardment Group bombed Rabaul and Simpson Harbor. One bomb plunged into the fantail of the light cruiser Tenryu, gnawing a 16-foot hole in her deck and damaging her superstructure, leaving 22 dead and 26 wounded. But the light cruiser received emergency repairs. For the period of early October, the Japanese strategy would be two intertwined tracks, bombing attacks by Base Air Force during the day and reinforcement of Guadalcanal by the Tokyo Express at night. Not every day, not every night, but enough to keep the Americans on edge while constantly nibbling away at their strength. On October 2nd, Base Air Force again tried its bait-and-switch tactic by baiting the Cactus Air Force with bombers, this time 9 Misawa G-4Ms who turned back, and the switch with 36 Zeros under the 6th Air Group's Lieutenant Kofukuda. The 1/6th Zero had to abort, and 8 Tainan Zeros did a U-turn with the Type 1s. After picking up the strike on radar at 12:20 p.m., the Cactus Air Force was ready, with 36 Wildcats, 10 from Marine Fighting 223, 12 from Marine Fighting 224, and 14 from the Saratoga's Fighting 5, in the air. But the warning had actually come too late, and the Zeros had a significant altitude advantage over the Wildcats, an advantage they used skillfully. Now it was a disaster for the Cactus Air Force. 5 Wildcats were shot down, though of these, 2 pilots, Major John L. Smith and Major Bob Gaylor, returned. One more Wildcat apparently crashed from pilot hypoxia after oxygen failure. To top it off, 2 search Dauntlesses disappeared as well, and all they got was 1 Zero shot down. With the daily air attack over, it was now the turn of the nightly Tokyo Express run. Destroyers Asagumo, Natsugumo, Minegumo, Urasame, and Harusame ran in, dropped off troops and supplies, and ran out. The first of the really big Tokyo Expresses came on October 3rd. For that, Base Air Force wanted a repeat of its ambush of the day before, with the same bait and switch. This time, it was Lieutenant Ito leading 27 Zeros. But Ito wasn't from the Konoya Air Group anymore. On October 1st, the famous Konoya Air Group had been renamed the 751 Air Group and the Takao Air Group the 753 Air Group. After all, there's no better time to change the names of your air groups from something distinctive with which everyone was familiar to some semi-secret numeric code than in the middle of a critical phase of a critical air campaign. So Lieutenant Ito of the 751 Air Group led 27 Zeros who had played the switch when 15 unarmed G4Ms played the bait. Radar picked them up. Donald Kennedy warned. Fighters scrambled. The Bettys turned back. Once again there was heavy cloud cover, which prevented Lieutenant Ito from seeing any defending fighters and vice versa, for the moment at least. The Japanese fighters became separated in the clouds into three sections, none of whom could communicate with each other due to their lack of radios. One section of 9-0s of the 3rd Air Group under Lieutenant J.G. Yamaguchi Sadao looped back looking for enemy fighters, and he found them, diving on him from behind. The Americans had adjusted to the bait-and-switch technique by stacking the fighters vertically at multiple altitudes. 5 Marine Wildcats under Captain Marion Carl had settled at about 30,000 feet when they saw Lieutenant Yamaguchi's section beneath them and dove like hawks on prey. 3 Zeros were shot down, a 4th had to ditch, and a 5th, Yamaguchi's, crashed near the beach. The other 2 sections of Zeros never got into the fight, but Petty Officer First Class Imahashi Takeru from the 751 group decided to lead his flight of 3 in strafing the airfield. The 3rd Defense Battalion had other ideas and trained all of its anti-aircraft guns on the Zeros. Imahashi ended up embedding his Zero into the ground just west of the runway. The other 2 were heavily damaged, but somehow managed to stagger back to base. The Saratoga's fighter skipper, Lieutenant Commander Simpler, thought the attack was without other objective than to measure the effectiveness of our anti-aircraft fire. It was the aerial version of the bonsai charge. Carl's fighters were the only ones able to engage the Zeros. Altogether, 6 Zeros were shot down, 2 more crashed, and yet another 2 had to be written off for battle damage. Lieutenant Colonel Bauer, a guest in this flight of combat air patrol, shot down 4 by himself. For all that, the U.S. lost 1 fighter, whose pilot parachuted to safety, and 1 that crash-landed. It was an aerial victory that was cathartic for the Cactus Air Force after the previous day's disaster, but their main concern was the convoy they knew was coming that night. It would indeed be a giant Tokyo Express. Destroyers Uranami, Makigumo, and Akigumo were to drop off 320 men and 16 tons of supplies at Tassafaronga. Destroyers Arashi, Kuroshio, and Hayashio would do the same thing at Kamimbo. But the really significant reinforcement was the seaplane carrier Nishin, with an escort of destroyers Nowaki and Maikaze, planning to stop at Tassafaronga as well. In her sizable hold, she carried 9 artillery pieces, including 4 150mm guns, 330 troops, and General Maruyama Masao, commander of the 2nd Sendai Division. The Nishin was so important to the Japanese that they had air cover of 6 Zeros from the 2nd Air Group stay over her so long that they could not return to base and had to ditch. 8 Dauntlesses and 3 Avengers took off in the late afternoon and managed to miss the Japanese Zeros, but also managed to miss the Nishin with their munitions. The Nishin reached Tassafaronga and began offloading her troops and supplies. But she was surprised at 10 p.m. when a night attack by 5 Dauntlesses got a near miss that started a leak in her engine room. The Americans were bombing a stopped ship with the air full of flares and still managed to get only a near miss. Nevertheless, between the near miss and increased American radio traffic, the Japanese decided to cut short her visit to Guadalcanal, and she left with 80 troops and 2 artillery pieces still on board. The big new destroyer, Akizuki, with increased heavy anti-aircraft armament, was dispatched from Shortland to meet the Nishin to help cover her return. The Nishin would prove to be a thorn in the American side, delivering Japanese troops and supplies while eluding truly damaging strikes by U.S. air power. And this night the Nishin was truly damaging, for she had dropped off General Maruyama. Maruyama was the typical Imperial Japanese Army general, arrogant, overconfident, ruthless, with both the enemy and his own troops. In his order of the day for October 1st, Maruyama said of Guadalcanal, "This is the decisive battle, a battle in which the rise or fall of the Japanese Empire will be decided. If we do not succeed in the occupation of these islands, no one should expect to return alive." The next morning, the Cactus Air Force set out again to take out the Nishin. 7 Dauntlesses and 4 Avengers took off after the seaplane carrier, but 4 of the SBDs under the Saratoga's Lieutenant Commander Kern had to dodge into a cloud to avoid Japanese floatplanes and never found the Nishin again. The Avengers attacked without success, again. To add injury to insult, During the fight, a flight of B-17s from the 11th Bombardment Group came through on the way back home from an attack on Buka. One of the Type Zero reconnaissance seaplanes performed its own bonsai charge by intentionally ramming one of the flying fortresses. The Japanese crew parachuted and was picked up by the Akizuki, but the B-17 crew was killed. Base Air Force did not attack Guadalcanal for the next 2 days because they were trying to cover a Japanese convoy to Buna on New Guinea. The Japanese had not given up on New Guinea, even as they tried to build up their forces on Guadalcanal, which continued the night of October 4th, as destroyers Shiguri, Fubuki, Shiraoyuki, Murakumo, and Ayanami dropped off 750 troops and supplies at Kamimbo. The Japanese reinforcements were getting too ridiculous even for Admiral Gormley, though the risk-averse South Pacific commander was probably motivated more by his meetings with Admiral Nimitz. On October 1st, Gormley's operations officer asked the Hornets' Admiral Murray, "How would you like to do an operation against Buin and Faisi?" It was music to Murray's ears. "That's exactly what we're here for. That's the only employment for carriers in this area, to go up and hit them and get out." A three-pronged strike was to take place October 5th. One part involved the Cactus Air Force attacking the home of Louis the Louse, the Japanese seaplane base at Rakata Bay. A second part involved 11th Bombardment Group B-17s bombing the Buka airfield. Both strikes were intended to suppress Japanese air power for the main event, an attack by the air attack group of the carrier Hornet on the staging area for Japanese reinforcements, the harbors of Tonole on Bougainville and Faisi on the tiny island of the same name, one of the Shortland Islands and off the eastern tip of Shortland itself. The distance between the two harbors was some 25 miles. The waters between Bougainville, Shortland, and Faro Islands formed a large, vaguely triangular, sheltered anchorage. It was a safe space for ships, at least Japanese ones. The Japanese kept attacking the American staging area at Henderson Field. It was time to return the favor. It was a good plan with one problem. Weather. The day of the attack, October 5th, the weather over the Northern Solomons was stormy, with heavy rain and lightning. Only one of the B-17s found their target at Buka. Only 8 Dauntlesses and 3 Avengers of the Cactus Air Force found Rakata Bay. Lieutenant Eldridge found his SPD the target of 3 Pete Type Zero observation seaplanes and was forced to ditch what was rescued. The strike on Rakata accomplished very little. The centerpiece of the operation, the Hornet's airstrike, was scattered by the weather as well. Only 2 fighters and 8 Dauntlesses found Tonole, where they managed to shoot up some Toko Air Group seaplanes on the water, but little else. Only 7 Avengers and 5 Wildcats found Faisi, where they ran into a little opposition from floatplanes, but again accomplished very little. But that afternoon, scouting Dauntlesses from Henderson Field found the next Tokyo Express, 170 miles west of Guadalcanal, destroyer Asagumo, leading destroyers Minigumo, Murasame, Natsugumo, Yudachi, and Harusame in bringing 650 troops, 2 field guns, and ammunition to Guadalcanal. An airstrike of 9 Dauntlesses, led by the Saratoga's Lieutenant Commander Kern, was quickly launched. The Cactus Air Force pilots found the Japanese ships without air cover at 3:45 p.m. and went into their dive-bombing attacks. Once again, they could not land a clean hit. 2 near misses off both bows of the Minegumo caused flooding and reduced her best speed to 14 knots. The Natsugumo had to escort her back to Shortland. The Murasame was also compelled to turn back after being damaged by near misses. 2 more strikes from Henderson Field could not find the 3 remaining destroyers and managed to lose 2 Avengers in the dark as well. Nevertheless, the day was not a total washout from the standpoint of damage inflicted on the enemy or turning back part of a Tokyo Express. There was also a benefit of which the Americans were unaware. After she had launched her airstrikes, the Hornet had turned around to get as far away from Rabaul as possible. At 12:04 p.m., her combat air patrol shot down 1 Betty from the Misawa Air Group on a reconnaissance mission. About 40 minutes later, they shot down a 2nd Betty, this one commanded by Petty Officer 2nd Class Yamada Shizuo. Neither scout plane got off a contact report, but between the loss of 2 scout planes and the attack on the Shortland's anchorage, Base Air Force concluded there must be a carrier out there. Admiral Tsukahara decided not to attack Guadalcanal for the next few days, while his scouts tried again to locate the American carrier so his G-4Ms could take her out. The Tokyo Express runs continued on October 6th. protected from air attack by rain, the Uranami, Shikinami, Hayashio, Nowaki, Kuroshio, and Noyashio managed to land 4 regimental guns, 450 army troops, and 150 naval infantry of the 4th Maizuru Special Naval Landing Force at Tassafaranga,